Hey, everybody, if you have a seat available next to you, can you kind of scrunch towards the middle so that the... put your hand up so that the seats available are on the outside and people can fill in. Thanks. And now a word from our sponsor.
Hi, my name is Tina Marquis, and I'm on the board for the Conference of World Affairs, and I'm so privileged to serve on the board of the Conference of World Affairs. It's an event that means so much to me, and I was so happy to be to increase my involvement. I'm also on the fundraising committee, and I just want to suggest that if you all value the event as much as I do, you might want to contribute financially to the event this year so that we continue to maintain the quality of the programming. We can keep bringing speakers that have different backgrounds and maintain the diversity of viewpoints that we hear and keep it free for all of us. So I hope that you consider it. There'll be envelopes as you exit the room, or you can go onto your app and donate, or you can go to the website and donate and help CWA thrive. Thank you.
Thank you. We are ultra precise here at CWA. We still have 5 minutes, so I will be back in 5 minutes.
I got you.
How long have you been loyal?
Trust you. Oh, since 1990.
My 10th year here.
Before that, I taught at Texas Tech Law School.
So how are things in Florida?
Let's do it. I'm a boulder.
You're still trying to get back to abnormal?
Yes. I served at the local congressman.
Unless you knew where to look, you wouldn't see any signs of the
land. Yeah, now you're going to
be. Hello.
Ask it. I don't know.
It's on wheels, system.
It is.
Just only. That way you can see it.
I can see
it.
And
called you responsible.
Only for that.
I think totally. I'm sure where you did. I'd be very disappointed.
The election of 1800.
That better.
What did that do that hadn't been done?
Well, it told each elector
in the
politics, if you still have two votes, you've got to designate one for president and one for vice president. Before that, it was
a fairly
common line and second. You've got Aaron Burr's
shot.
We've got Aaron Burr and shoot Hamilton.
You got Hamilton killed.
No, it didn't change anything other than...
It just changed president and vice president.
It did two things. Top three, like there's not a majority, but top three, there's not a ballot. The top three go into the House rather than the top five. Each elector has to designate one vote for president and one for vice president. That way there won't be a tie.
But didn't that mean to do with this? Effectively, really reinforced the establishment of the two-party system.
Well, it was because of the two-party system that the 12th Amendment was needed, yes. But the two-party system had already started in 1960, and it gave them Jefferson as vice president. Anything that's reinforced with the two-party system, they would know. That's why we don't have a fractured parliamentary democracy.
They've all been
quite substantial. This is a Nation magazine kind of trendy group, I think.
I don't know about that. I think they mainly come from the Louisiana.
That's
I'll tell you a story about
it. Boy, is there. It's so palpable. I don't know how you can stand being here.
I have a doctor in Boulder.
What's that?
Doctor in Boulder. He moved to Boulder, Louisiana in 1983.
Oh, wow.
And he said, when I came to Boulder, I didn't realize there was such a thing as a non-corrupt politician.
Nice.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I covered a lot of elections in Louisiana. And my favorite was not the first David Duke election, but the second.
Was that the one with Edwin Edwards?
It was Edwin Edwards because he'd done, it was up against Johnson.
Right.
And I was at an event And this,
I have not.
Duke
the only,
late,
only
I'm at the event. One of his support. I'm up there with a woman, and the supporter comes up.
Do you have
and
them?
He starts going, "You look Cornish by background."
Do you have? Do you have?
I said, "That's amazing. I am Cornish." He turns to the woman next to me, and she says, "He goes, well, you look Eastern European, maybe like Hungarian and some Jewish." Yeah. And the woman says, "Yeah, that's really interesting." And he's going around, and he's one of these people who, like, by your facial characteristics, he's
pretty good.
Well, Duke's people were, Duke had some serious analysts of the white race in his constituents.
Do you remember the bumper sticker that Edmund Everett had was so popular on Kevin Hart?
Vote for the crook.
It's important.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Only in Louisiana. Only in Louisiana.
Such amazing power.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. What a wonderful turnout for a very interesting panel. I'm very much looking forward to it. My name is Andy Schulteis. I will be your moderator for this afternoon. This is session 3515, entitled, Is It Time to Dump the Electoral College? We will be together for the next 80 minutes. The way this works is each of the panelists next to me will speak for about 10 minutes or so on the topic, and then we will throw it open to questions. And this year we have this fancy new system for getting semi-working, yes, although it's currently working. Ooh, I got a message. No, it's still working. While the speakers are speaking, if you come up with a question, please sign into your app, if you have it, and send the question in, and it'll pop up on my iPhone, and I'll ask it. If you don't have the app or don't have a phone or don't want to do it that way, we do have index cards, and our two producers, who I think have temporarily left the room, could the producers please raise their hand? There's one of them. There she is. One of the producers will have a raise her hand, and they will distribute an index card to you to write it, and we'll pick it up and send it back up to me. I will read all the questions unless you explicitly say otherwise, that you want to read it yourself, in which case you'll have to shout because there won't be a microphone. And finally, if you are a CU student, please indicate that on your question because, as always, you get priority in asking questions. So, the question, gentlemen, is it time to dump the Electoral College? And we will begin with Professor James Viator from Loyola College School of Law in Louisiana, former rock and roller, former oil and gas guy, former lots of stuff, and a very interesting guy I just met. So, Professor Viator, take it away.
Thank you. So it's a nice crowd to get through the shank of the day. Thank you for showing up. I have a feeling that if we were holding this shortly after the 1960 election, the room wouldn't be so full because Nixon won the popular vote in 1960, but Kennedy won the electoral vote. So things can always turn out. The flip of the coin can flip. But my task to begin, since I'm a constitutional historian, is just to talk about how the Electoral College got created, why it was created. Later on, we can talk about good, bad, ugly. As far as editorial comment, I think it all boils down, if you remove yourself from any particular election, which I know is hard to do, it boils down to whether you're a consolidationist, that is a nationalist, who wants direct popular election of the president, or if you want to maintain some role for the federal principle, the state and local involvement. I think that's the real value choice, apart from whether you wanted Nixon to win in 1960 or you wanted Gore to win in 2000. That's the real philosophical choice. But enough of that. I'm done with all the philosophy I know. Now I'm going to talk about how it was created. It was, like so much else in the Philadelphia Convention, the product of bitter debate and compromise. And as Lord Dicey said, a great English constitutional historian talking about the work of the Constitutional Convention, they built better than they knew, or even than they intended, because everything of major importance was a compromise. And by the time the electoral they could not decide on how to elect the president. It didn't get decided until September. And remember, the convention was over on September 15th. They had discussed it all through the summer, but the huge debate that sent people home and almost disrupted the convention was what you all learn in civics, the small state, big state divide. That the big populous states wanted both houses of Congress to be based on population, and the smaller states wanted the central legislature, the national legislature, to be based entirely on state representation, the way it had been in the Articles of Confederation. So the Virginia plan, big populous state, was direct election of the president, big populous state, they like that, and also both houses of Congress based on representation. New Jersey plan was exactly the opposite, election of the president by the national legislature, voting by states, with each state having an equal vote. And that was the huge sticking point from June 1st until July 16th, when the Connecticut Compromise was offered. But they didn't touch the presidency. There was already enough heat in the room, and they decided, okay, the Senate will represent the states. Every state, no matter the population, will have two votes. The senators will be sent there by the states as ambassadors of the states to the new central government. And then the House, as we know, is based on population, apportionment every 10 years, and you get the number of people voting in the House based on the population of the state. But still, the state principle. It's not a national chamber based on population. It's a chamber based on population aggregated state by state. So that was the compromise. And it wasn't until September that they finally settled on the Electoral College as a compromise that would satisfy both of those factions. The two big choices the two choices that were discussed most of the summer. The Electoral College was actually proposed by James Wilson, a very bright Scottish lawyer, on June 2nd, and nobody paid much attention to it because nobody really liked it. It ended up winning because it was everybody's second choice, but hardly anybody's first choice. The first choice for a large majority of the delegates was election of the president by the National Congress, whether just the Senate or both voting together. And then the other one that James Madison favored, the big states favored, was direct election of the president, sort of a national plebiscite for the president. And as that big state, small state conflict, neither one of those positions could prevail. So finally they looked at James Wilson's proposal, which had sat on the table since June 2nd, and said, okay, this is nobody's first choice, but it's everybody's second choice. And it was the Electoral College, essentially as we know it today, but modified by the 12th Amendment. So the interesting thing about why it was appealing at the time has evolved away. The appeal at the time was people began to realize that if we elect the president by the legislature, he's going to be in thrall to the legislature, and we will not have an independent executive. On the other hand, if he's elected by a direct popular vote, the states have all been ignored, the federal principle has been ignored, and their phrase was, the man on the white horse can more easily get elected. The man on the white horse, unattached to any particular party, to any particular state, the charismatic, Napoleonic, Julius Caesar type leader. And they were worried about that. So the Electoral College would filter the popular vote through this ballot of state electors. It was left to each state to decide how to elect its electors to go to the college. The electors were going to be based on state population. As filtered through the Connecticut Compromise, that is, everybody gets the number of representatives they have as electors plus two more for their senators. So that's how the electors were chosen, still tied into the population of the states. But what everybody expected would happen, and if you look at the original unamended Constitution, This is what they thought, as George Mason said in the convention, 19 out of 20 presidential elections will go to the House of Representatives, where you will vote by state. Each house would caucus. Each state would caucus, and they'd come up with one vote for the president. So it was going to be a House of Representatives caucus who would vote for the president. And the reason they thought they would go to the House was because it was before there was a two-party system, and the original Constitution said the top five vote-getters, that's how many people they thought would be running before the party system, and that everybody would vote for their state favorite son, which would take a lot of electors out, but all the electors get two votes, so one would go in every state for their state favorite son, and then they think about somebody else and maybe vote for the guy next door or somebody of national prominence, and there'd be five of them, and nobody would have a majority and of electors, electoral votes, and so it would go to the House, and the House would decide. That's where they thought all the action was going to take place. And that reinforced the federal principle, but it was still grounded in state popular voting. Well, because of the rise of the two-party system, that didn't happen. By the election of 1800, it had broken down. The election of 1796, also one more thing was changed by the 12th Amendment. The original Constitution just said each elector in the college gets two votes, period. It didn't say one for president, one for vice president. It did say no double voting. You can't pile up two votes on one candidate. It was expected one vote would go for the favorite son, and then one would go for some national candidate. As the parties began developing in the election of 1796, you had the very uncomfortable position of a Federalist, John Adams, serving with the second vote-getter, his vice president, Thomas Jefferson, and they hated each other. And they were from two different parties. The election of 1800 got even more complicated because the electors realized by that point, well, we got to be careful about how we're voting so that we don't get the second top vote-getter from the other party. So the electors realized that. But what it meant was, for example, all of the Republican electors, Jefferson was running for president, Aaron Burr for vice president, they realized somebody's got to throw away their vote for Burr and just not vote. And that way the top vote-getter will be Jefferson and then second will be Burr. Well, some Goomba forgot to throw away his vote. And so Jefferson and Burr were tied, and Burr, not being one to miss an opportunity, did not step aside for Jefferson and sent the election into the House, 36 ballots, 2 weeks, got Alexander Hamilton killed because he knew what a scoundrel Aaron Burr was. Remember, Aaron Burr tried to get Louisiana Territory to leave the Union and start its own nation. God damn it, it didn't work. So close. As my dad used to say, boy, it's a good thing we beat the British at the Battle of New Orleans, otherwise we'd all be speaking English today in Louisiana. So close. One of those great missed opportunities in history. But at any rate, so Hamilton, not so much because he loved Jefferson, but he knew Jefferson was a man of honor and that Burr was a snake in the grass. He got the New York delegation to give their votes to Jefferson, and that got Hamilton killed in the most famous duel in American history a little later. That created the 12th Amendment, and all it did was two minor changes to the Electoral College. Now each elector still has two votes, but he has to vote one designated for president and one designated for vice president. And by that time, the party system was in place, so they knew who the presidential and vice presidential candidates were they were going to vote for. And the other was, now they realize it's not going to go to the House of Representatives very often because of the two-party system. And so it was lowered from the top five Electoral College vote-getters to the top three would go into the House of Representatives. And that did happen in 1824, where there were the Electoral College was split amongst four, and the top three went into the House of Representatives, where John Quincy Adams prevailed. And that's history. That's the Cliff's Notes version of the history of the Electoral College. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And next we have John Nichols. John is, I'm sure most of you know, a writer for The Nation and has appeared many times on NPR, where I am now able to put a face with a voice. also the co-founder of Free Press and as many other things in his lifetime. Very honored to introduce John Nichols.
Thank you so much. This guy has been on, this is our third panel together, and it is true that he did start with rock and roll.
And should have stayed there, right?
As did I. What did you play, brother?
Drums and guitar.
Steve with guitar, I'm a drummer. Senator, are you instruments that you play? Do you play any instrument coming up?
I played the instrument of popular opinion.
That's useless. So you will be, he will be the singer. All right.
No.
Booking agent.
No, he'll be singing. You got any playing instrument, brother?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What do you play?
I was a fierce trombonist.
Fantastic. Oh, yes.
We got a band next year's jazz performance. You're looking at it right here.
The Mixed Nuts. How about that for a name? The Mixed Nuts.
All right. I know this is a brutal thing to do to people because you're all so comfortable and settled in. But talking about revolutionary times and revolutionary things, so I would ask everyone to please stand up.
I feel like I'm at church.
Amen. So I promise you this will not be embarrassing. And when I ask people to sit down, in many ways you're going to want to be sitting down. You know, so don't feel insulted when I ask folks to do it. Would all the women in the room please sit down?
Oh.
No, just stick with me, sister. You're going to like where we're headed. All right. Would all the people of color, people who identify as people of color, please sit down? All right. Would, now this is not true in every place, but let's, you know, because some it was, we'll take the chance of it. Would anyone who's a religious dissenter, somebody who doesn't sort of buy into, a mainstream sort of Protestant religious grouping or theory?
Only Protestant?
Kind of, pretty much. It's a little bit of flexibility. Anybody who's not a rich white guy. Okay. All right, well. No, stay up. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce you to the person in the room that the founders anticipated choosing a president of the United States, this fine gentleman. So when we talk about the founding of the American experiment and electoral college, let us understand that the fact that the electoral college is anti-democratic and destructive to basic premises of democracy itself, that's just a footnote to the broader problem. These were people who were not thinking about putting the people in charge, right? They accepted that African Americans would be 3/5 of human beings because they still wanted to get counted for purposes of government services and any benefits and actual voting. They just didn't want to treat them as human beings. Women also did not, were just not invited to the table. And so, you understand, the Electoral College was founded in original sin. if we are a country that has a faith in democracy itself, in the basic premises of democracy, we can be a democratic republic, we can have direct right, but if you like democracy itself, this country wasn't founded on that premise. Now, I'm the most patriotic person you're going to meet. I get a tear in my eye when I see the flag coming down the street. I live in Madison, Wisconsin, named after James Madison. Every street, yes, thank you, people. And every street coming off our Capitol is named after a signer of one of the people who ratified the Constitution. And I think it's an incredible document, and I have immense interest in it and faith in it. And I love the wisest of our founders who said, we're maybe not perfect. And so we make a lot of really, we could be making some pretty serious mistakes. The biggest mistake that future generations will make is to take what we have handed off to you and accept it as something written in stone and handed down to Michelle Bachmann. I know they said exactly like that, but that was the basic premise. And so they said we should amend it a lot. They amended it. They were so resistant to amendments, they did 10 in the first 4 years. And some of the other amendments were kind of interesting. They got the women in. People, I know it took a little while, people of color. We even, in 1964, we even got rid of the poll tax. We said if you weren't a rich white guy, that was cool. And we said 18 to 21 year olds. We've expanded democracy constantly. We've changed the nature of the presidency. We've changed the nature of Congress and how it sits and when it sits. We've done all sorts of amendments. And I will begin my remarks today simply by saying it is time to amend the Constitution of the United States to get rid of the Electoral College. It's a horrible entity, worse than the worst machine in Las Vegas, right? I mean, and many people will say, you know, well, yeah, but you wouldn't say that. Yeah, I probably would dispute 1960. I'm going to still say that Kennedy pulled it off by 112,827 votes. But we can dispute that because I do live just north of Illinois. But what I will tell you is, I have advocated for the elimination of the Electoral College since I heard of it. Since I was, like, this is like high school days. And Democrat, Republican, Independent, Liberal, Conservative, whoever you are, if you favor this thing, if you favor this foul, dysfunctional, horrible, awful institution, which actually says the people themselves are not capable, the people should not be allowed to have the final say in this country, that we fought a revolution against King George to make sure that we wouldn't be in charge. If you believe that, then that's fine, you go with what you want. But if you don't believe that, you have to believe we need to get rid of it, and you have to stop worrying about who it advantages in this election or who it advantages in that election. My dear, you know, like, President Donald Trump, he said right before the 2012 election, I quote him, I think he was right, it's the only thing I actually strongly agree with him on. But he said the Electoral College is a disaster for democracy. Now, he said it when his side looked like it might lose in the Electoral College. It's an amazing thing. They asked him about it recently, and he said, you know, I'm starting to rethink, you know, I kind of like it. But that's the problem with the Electoral College. It's a game. It's a game, not a reality. And this game, in the last 16 years, has prevented the person who got the most votes for President of the United States from becoming President of the United States. And that has consequences. And if you don't believe it has consequences, I would invite you to look at Iraq. The simple fact that I'm not saying Al Gore would have been perfect. That's not my promise to you. But the truth of the matter is, who becomes president matters. And for us to say, oh, well, yeah, we're just going to leave it to chance and let Florida throw in some things and that'll sort it out. This is a horrible approach to forming a country. And it is also, when we say it's anti-democratic, I'm not even so worried about that top line anti-democracy. The top line anti-democracy is when, you know, the first woman who's got a shot at becoming president of the United States gets just about 3 million more votes. And like every woman who's had to train the incompetent manager in the bank, doesn't get the top job. And so that's the top line problem. But here's the core problem. And I know my colleague, who I love, and I'm going to be proud drumming behind him in the next year. And he loves the states and all this, and I love the states. I'm a Wisconsin nationalist. Anybody from Wisconsin knows that. But if you're from Wyoming in 2016, and you voted for Donald Trump, you had to get about 55,000 of your friends together to get an electoral vote for Donald Trump. If you're from California and you voted for Hillary Clinton, you had to get around, you know, in the range of 150,000 to 200,000 people together. So it's roughly, they say it's roughly a 3.6 to 1 ratio as regards where you live. Even if your electoral vote counts for, you know, representing. So the Electoral College does not represent equal numbers of people voting for that job. It's not even coming out of state and saying, well, you're a small state, but you still get your proportion. No, it's nothing like that. The Electoral College is weighted toward extremely small states. Now, I love Vermont. But here's the challenge of that. Some of you are upset that Hillary Clinton didn't become president last year. Okay, I accept that. Some of you wish it was Bernie Sanders. I accept that. But here's the bottom line on the whole thing. What we ought to be concerned about as regards this election. Hillary Clinton got 3 million more, roughly 3 million more popular votes than Donald Trump for president. But she didn't become president. If you actually do the math on the Electoral College, we haven't even plumbed the depths of it. It is incredibly possible in this country with a series of close elections in big states, and then you pile up the small states, to have someone get elected president of the United States with barely a third of the popular vote. You can have two-thirds of the people in this country opposing a presidential candidate, and that person could still become president because of the Electoral College. Now you say, well, yeah, you could have multi-candidates, blah, blah, blah. I just want to close off with this notion. Two times in 16 years, someone has gotten more votes and not become president of the United States. The first time, it was almost 500,000 votes. The second time, it was almost 3 million votes. What will the next time be? 10 million votes? 15 million votes? And how thoroughly will that undermine the credibility and the functionality of our democracy? I don't care if you're a conservative Republican or a liberal Democrat. I don't care what your values are. I don't care where you come from. I'm going to tell you, if you love this country, if you want this country to have strength and functioning in the future, you need to get rid of this foul and destructive interruption of our democratic process.
Hey!
Thank you. Thank you, John. James Wilson is rolling in his grave as we speak. Before we get to our cleanup hitter, can the producers raise their hand one more time? Again, I only have three questions so far, which shocks me. So if that's probably because the system isn't working. So if you need a card, please raise your hand. Onward. I'm very, very honored to be able to introduce Senator Tim Wirth. The senator represented Boulder for many years, both as a House member and as a senator. I think the first Democrat elected from Boulder, is that right?
For a long time.
But that's not why he's my hero. He's my hero because after he left politics, he didn't start lobbying people and making huge amounts of money and doing what they do. He teamed up with Ted Turner and started the United Nations Foundation and the Better World Fund. He still serves with them, I believe, doing wonderful things all over the world. So it's my very great honor to introduce Senator Tim Wirth.
Good. Well, thank you very much, and I'm delighted to see so many people here. This is obviously an issue that gets people's blood going. Bad, ugly, foul disruption.
Yeah. And that was just because I was with a U.S. senator.
All statesmanlike language. When I was in the House, we had a famous hearing one time with Robert Strauss. Bob Strauss was probably the most famous lawyer in the country at that time, was also chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And he was telling us about, some process that had occurred in his life in the state of Texas. And we were all pretty outraged that, in fact, this had gone on. And he looked up at the panel with a smile and he said, "Ain't bragging if you can do it." Now, that is reflective in part of where we are with the Electoral College. I think there's a really serious question to ask ourselves that if we don't like the Electoral College, and I think the Electoral College on the surface seems to me to be uniquely undemocratic, and but we have to look behind that and say, okay, what would we replace it with? Sounds good if you say it fast enough to get rid of the Electoral College, but what are we going to do in terms of replacing it? Are we really serious about the implications and the ramifications of this? And it cuts both ways. In 2004, you may remember John Kerry was the presidential candidate, came within Ohio, and we thought he had won that night in Ohio. Who knows what happens with the counting machines in Ohio? But had John Kerry won Ohio in 2004, he would have been the president. But he also would have been a seriously minority president, as George W. Bush had millions more votes than John Kerry did. So this cuts, you know, in different ways. What we have to learn, it seems to me, is to think about the Electoral College and say, okay, do we really want to have a popular vote? One, to get from here to there, to change the constitutional nature of this, we're going to have a constitutional amendment. There already is a lot of pressure out across the country to have a constitutional convention, people that want to have, you know, no controls on any kind of guns whatsoever, people who want to outlaw abortion. I mean, there's a list from here to the library of the items that I think most people in this room would find significantly unsavory and you would not like to see in the Constitution. But there's great pressure out there, and we're very close to having the number of states approving having a constitutional convention. I worry that this issue adds even further fuel, you know, and we haven't really thought about it, but boy, let's have a constitutional convention or let this occur, because that's a way of getting rid of this dreadful, bad, ugly, foul disruption called the Electoral College. Assuming we wanted to get rid of it, so what would we do? What would we replace it with? Do we want to have some process of direct election of the president across the country? Well, maybe. But what happens if there are a number of very close states across the country? We have an election, a lot of very close states. They get challenged. We have recounts in 2, 5, 9 states. And we have no decision on the election until you get well into the very next year. I'm not sure that that's a process that we all, you know, would want to see. And so it seems to me potentially a very disruptive process. The Electoral College, for the most part, and I'll come back to what I think its biggest problem is, the Electoral College does give you the opportunity to have a decision that gets made, you know, by the electors on the day in December in which they all come together. We actually get a decision. And we know from our own history that these things can go on and on and on. You know, most issues in Congress are being refought. They were there 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 80 years ago. You know, my view is to do the best we can not to have such a thing. I get very worried about the idea of a convention. I don't like the idea of having, you know, heavily regional candidates. If you have direct popular election, do we want to be in a situation in which, say, what are red states now, predominantly in one area of the country, would really focus and get a majority of votes, and maybe those of us of a different way of thinking would find ourselves in a smaller situation. We get real regional candidates. You know, I think in a way the Electoral College helps to provide us with the opportunity to have more balance across the country in terms of the votes that a candidate gets. Final point that I make is that given this system, I think it's extremely important that people who are running for president understand how to manage campaigns against the system, you know, and put together a good campaign. We know where the Electoral Colleges were. We know in this last election, for example, where the firewall was. We know that it's Pennsylvania. We know that it's Michigan. And we found out that it was Wisconsin. Now, that in retrospect, and even then, was pretty obvious. But the kind of election, the kind of campaigns that occurred to go after those Electoral Colleges, you know, were not very good. I mean, Hillary did not go to Wisconsin a single time in the whole campaign. I don't understand that. We know what the rules are, and we know how to do it. We're now going to say this is a terrible, horrible system because she didn't, you know, win in a few states. I think it's pretty clear she could and would have won in a few states. You have to manage the system that you have and manage it well. The only thing about the Electoral College that really worries me, the rest of it is nice to talk about and it's sort of academic and you do a great job. I think it's a wonderful explanation of our constitutional system and the balance of powers and the history of how we got where we are. It's fascinating how we arrived at the Electoral College. It's a great case study in American democracy and in the federalist system and in the balance of power and so on. Absolutely fascinating. But are we going to actually do something about it? Well, the one thing that does worry me is what happens if there's a tie in the Electoral College. The numbers of electors are even. It's not an odd number. It's an even number. So it is technically possible, and we've come close to that a few times, it's technically possible to have a tie in the Electoral College, at which point, as in 1824, it went to the House of Representatives. The top three candidates in this case would be the top two. Each state has one vote. Wyoming has the same vote in this process as New York or California. So by, you know, getting into this situation, how many, just think of the reality of today, how many state legislatures today are blue and how many are red? Were there to be a tie, you know, in the Electoral College, and it went to the states to make a decision, I think it would be hands down, it would be a red state person. That's the one thing about the Electoral College today that really bothers me. I worry and I think about how might people start to game the elections in such a way that they can focus on getting a tie in the Electoral College. This is really playing long arts, but you know, maybe this is part of their overall strategy, that they play long ball on this and try to figure out if we do this, if we win this state, if we win that state, then our fallback position or we have as an insurance policy having a tie, and if we have a tie, you know, we're going to win. I will say that from, again, from a partisan point of view, Republicans are much, much better at this than the Democrats are. Much, much better kind of thinking through what can be done, how can be done, how you might do it, where do you invest your money, and so on. So in summary, you know, I understand that what it sounds like. The Electoral College sounds grossly undemocratic. But I say to myself, what am I going to replace it with? You know, what are the ramifications of this? You know, that, it seems to me, are a set of questions before we sort of raise the banner and charge down Pearl Street and say we're going to get rid of the Electoral College. Let's make sure we really think about it before we leap.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, we have a bunch of questions now, so I'll try to get to as many as I can, and I apologize if I don't get to yours or can't read your handwriting. All right, so this is the first one comes from a student, and it's not directed at anyone, so anyone can answer. In my understanding, the Constitution does not require a popular vote to nominate electors. Is there potentially a better way, such as having a state senate decide its own electors to nominate, electors that would distill the current myth of the popular vote?
Well, I think we've done a really good job of dispelling the myth of the popular vote already. Letting state senates do it, I mean, if we're going to go that route, we might as well pick our rich white guy and have him take it all. You know, because I like his look and I think I can trust him. But the fact of the matter is, you know, this student brought up one of the most important aspects. Do you know, I've written several books on these issues, and I've actually spent an immense amount of time looking at this. I was down, I looked in Florida after the very conflicted 2000 election between Bush and Gore. And do you know what some Florida legislators were saying as they were trying to do the recount, the one that the Supreme Court didn't really want? But as they were trying to do the recount, there were legislators who were saying, you know what, if that recount comes out a little bit for Gore, we got a Republican majority in this legislature, we're just going to declare the electors for Bush. And everybody's like, well, that's insane, right? You can't do that. And of course, you can. The Electoral College, and I love the senators, you know, this is, you
are the last great American senators. I mean, it's just that is a true. No, it's so true. No, because that is exactly what, and I'm, you know, look, I'm different. That is exactly what I want senators to do. It's reasoned, thoughtful, great approach, right? But what I want to promise you here is that was a reasoned, thoughtful, great approach to find a practical, you know, best practical answer in the difficult moment we are in. I want to get out of the difficult moment that we are in. I don't want it ever to be suggested that a state senate might choose the electors. I don't want to have elections decided by a minority of the voters. I want what was proposed and actually moved very well through the House in 1969 after we had a very close election. And in fact, what we again considered in the 1970s, this is an ancient history, we have had functional plans to get rid of the Electoral College that have actually passed houses of our Congress and have proposed very sound ways to do it. One way, Birch Bayh was the great advocate for it. And Birch Bayh, it was his great passion, was to get rid of the Electoral College. What he proposed is that if you have a popular vote, if somebody gets a minority, 2 weeks later you have a runoff election. And you if there are separate candidates taking on, somebody wins the majority of the vote and you're done. You have a president of the United States chosen by a majority of the people. And as regards recounts and the closeness of states, I want to tell you, right now, presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton's didn't, but Donald Trump's campaign had a total electoral college strategy in this race. And they picked the states they targeted, and they looked for those narrow wins that allowed them to get the presidency without even the plurality of the votes. So we're already down the rabbit hole.
And where were we in that process?
How
do we possibly condone, say, that kind of thing happening? It seems to me we also got to say there's certain ways, there are certain rules under which elections run. You may not like the rules, but they're the rules that exist. And if you have those rules, then you got to play by those rules. And if you're going to play by those rules, you want to play it as clearly and as well as you possibly can. They did have a great Electoral College strategy. We did not have a great Electoral College strategy, even winning by 3 million votes. Let's remember that. This takes the kind of tough, hard-nosed, clear-eyed thought about how do you get from here to there.
But I'm not going to save the Electoral
College. All right, I want to move on to the next question.
Save the Electoral College just because, you know, say, well, we got to keep the Electoral College because one side of that is going to get better in the next election. The fact of the matter is the Electoral College allows the loser of an election to become president of the United States of America. And losers shouldn't become president.
All right. Next question.
Check the Library of Congress.
This is an interesting one. It's slightly different. Would eliminating Electoral College increase voter participation? And now, this is now me speaking. So if you live in L.A., you're never going to see a candidate in your life. If you live in Iowa City, they're going to come to dinner with you. So will it be a better experience for the majority of United States citizens if there were a popular vote instead of an Electoral College?
So I don't think this is the most untoward result of going to a national plebiscite. But I think one result would be, is that the NSA telling me to shut up?
You clearly hit the third rail,
bro. Oh, no.
It can be open again. It's functional. This happened yesterday.
Did it?
See, we need our electric instruments right now.
Yeah. It is the NSA.
we'll sing a little song for you here while we wait. Or no, maybe we won't.
I think if you open it again, it does something.
Yeah, there's some way to jiggle it.
Yay. Okay, returning to point.
I just say we make those two president and vice president.
Okay, so when John starts talking again, somebody go hit the door again, all right? So there's a possibility, and you know, John and I have been on a couple of panels together, so we're all repeating ourselves. So I'm going to repeat something I said earlier, some people might have heard, which is I really believe in that great American philosopher Yogi Berra. It's really hard to make predictions, especially about the future. So I don't know what the result might be. It's a possibility, I think, that presidential campaigns become sort of bi-coastal campaigns or wherever the people happen to be in that election cycle, because you're looking for just a nationally aggregated majority.
This is if you have a majority. This is if you have just a majority.
And just a national plebiscite based on
with the
plurality. And you could have a runoff. Birch Bayh proposed a runoff with the top three. But at any rate, the votes are the candidates are going to go where the votes are. Now they go to the states because the votes are electoral college votes. But if it's just people, if it's just noses and heads, they're going to go where those are. And I think that might lead to even more disaffection of the sort you saw in the Trump phenomenon, which is nobody pays attention to us. And if in the national election, and that's the one election that everybody votes on, you know, the president, if in that election people are left out because they're in little small pockets, they might feel like, well, you know, I'm not in this at all. It's, you know, I don't have any skin in the game. That's a possibility. I don't think that's the biggest problem, but maybe somebody will ask a question about the national plebiscite and what I think it would what would really be bad about it. But I'm not going to do that unless somebody asks me that.
Under our current system, we have lower turnout in our presidential elections than Belgium and Germany and Italy and Norway and Sweden and Denmark and Iceland and Canada and Benin. There are about, I think, 70 more countries I could go through. We have horrible, awful turnout in America. It is a nightmare situation. And I happen to believe that we have low turnout in America because a lot of people believe it doesn't matter who they vote for. That low turnout is not merely because of our dysfunctional, foul electoral college. It is also because of gerrymandering. It is also because of the effects of money in politics and a host of other issues. There's a lot of things that make people not vote. And so when I argue for reform, I love the idea that between 1910 and 1920, this country amended the Constitution to give women the vote, to have an elected U.S. Senate, and to tax corporations. And strike, I will take three amendments to my Constitution, not a constitutional convention. I'll just take it up the old-fashioned way it's worked in the past. My amendments, eliminate the Electoral College, eliminate gerrymandering, and create a system where we have competitive districts to the best of our ability. I know that's difficult. And finally, I want to amend the Constitution of the United States to say that money isn't speech, corporations aren't people, and we have a right to elections for our votes that are voting in dollars. And you know what? Here's the thing. And if in the next election, after we do that, we don't get substantially higher turnout, I will join the movement to reverse it all.
There are several questions about this, specifically the National Vote Initiative. So this is one of them. As far as replacement strategies go, what are your thoughts on the National Vote Initiative, a system that is working its way through state legislatures to have them commit electoral vote based on the national popular vote? And now I will add as comment on that, the way that works is it only comes into effect if a state's representing a majority of electoral college approve it. And I do believe they are more than halfway there already.
I think they're at 11 states, but it happens in big states.
Yeah.
So it adds up to a lot.
So does anyone have any thoughts about that? I don't know if Colorado's one of them, actually. I don't think it is.
Failed in the Senate.
Yeah.
You tried.
I don't have a dog in that hunt, but I think one of the things that's good about the Electoral College is it supports the two-party system, and I would imagine both parties would resist this movement because the winner-take-all or unit rule now for the Electoral College in all but two states really magnifies the importance of the state, whether it's a democratically or a republicanly controlled state. That's bad grammar, but you know what I mean.
that it magnifies the importance of that state because the little Republican pockets or the little Democratic pockets in the state don't count for the Electoral College because it's winner take all, which is very Democratic. Who gets the most votes in the state? Well, then you win all of the Electoral College votes. And the party systems like that, the two-party systems like that, because it magnifies their power in the state. If they think they got a shot at the state, they get all the votes. It's winner take all. And so I think the national parties will be opposed to anything that really does away with the winner take all theory of the Electoral College, which is not in the Constitution. The states started deciding on that with the rise of the Jacksonian Party in the early 19th century.
Do you think there's any evidence that people's thinking about the Electoral College influences their vote or their interest in voting? I've never seen anything that suggested that. I think what people get worried about and what really depresses the vote are the way in which minorities are clearly discriminated against in the way that voting patterns are allowed. We just saw a reversal of the Texas law, which is really great. I mean, we ought to be going the other direction in terms of getting people to vote and encouraging them to vote. And what we've done in the state of Colorado in terms of having vote by mail and voting over a long-term period of time is really increasing the franchise. Those are the things that are important, and really focusing on those things that are important, they, in terms of the leverage of them, they really make a difference. So again, you've only got a limited amount of political capital to spend on particular issues. You know, and I will say, you know, from my perspective, the Electoral College is not one, you know, that it seems to me demands. We can all get unhappy about it and get riled up about it and so on. But in terms of actually making a difference, in terms of making our democratic system work better, I think there are a lot of other avenues that are going to produce, you know, a lot. Gerrymandering is another one. That's something that's left up to the states. That has to do with who gets elected in state legislatures. You know, that gets in who gets elected governor. That is much, it seems to me, that's where the real leverage is. You know, you can't sort of put a march down the street and say, get rid of the Electoral College and go home and feel good about it. Those other things take a lot of work, day in and day out. But that's what good politics is, a lot of work, day in and day out. Finally, on Los Angeles and Ames, Iowa, mm-hmm. You know, if you had a plebiscite, you know, I think that candidates would go to Houston and Los Angeles and Chicago and New York and Philadelphia and Miami. You know, you'd see him in Los Angeles. You'd never see him in Ames, Iowa.
Get shot at that.
So what?
Well, I'm not.
That was not a written question.
I was only reflecting. I was only.
Now we're getting like the Constitutional Congress. So I hope I didn't forget my quick rejoinder. First off, I don't happen to think that we are inferior to our ancestors. Generally. Our ancestors, 100 years ago, were able to, in a 10-year period, the votes for women and elected United States Senate, a tax system that actually allowed for progressive taxation, constitutional amendments, all, and also to lay down the basic underpinnings of a regulatory state and to begin to get rid of child labor, to protect women in the workplace, the rise of the trade union movement, all concentrated in a relatively brief progressive era. And so I think it is absurd to say that we can only do some things now because politics is hard and it takes a lot of energy. The fact
that's
of the
matter not the
is,
point.
No, I oh,
you're
it is
just
the point.
Games.
No, not at all. I think
you guys are more
you
honest.
Get, I am more honest as a historian. I'll tell you, you get reform moments where you don't do incrementalism, you actually fix stuff. And the bottom line is this: I respect you too much to believe that you would limit. I think we are in a moment right now where there's an incredible energy in this country. And I think that energy should be harnessed to use it as one of those rare moments where we make those changes that actually, I know you do. So we're going to actually fix this thing. And as regards our friend who yells about Ames, Iowa.
It was Iowa City, by the way, the initial metaphor.
That's what happens, that always happens to Iowa City. Ames always gets the credit. The Democratic Party in this last election, in its draft platform, had 43 words on rural America. Its rural section had 43 words. That was about 1,200 less than they had in 1976. So
So in 40 years, they dropped most of their language on rural America. I will tell you this. If you have a national popular vote, and you have two parties that are really, or more, competing nationally, I don't know whether you're going to get to Ames or to Iowa City, but I promise you the political parties will begin to speak to the whole of America on issues because they will desperately want to get every possible vote they can get out of rural America, out of urban America, and out of all those places, and we will have dramatically more issue-oriented campaigns because at the end of the day, that's one of the ways that you reach people. I'm not as concerned about whether Donald Trump taps the tarmac in Iowa City or Ames. I am very concerned that the Democratic Party had 42 or 43 words on rural America when they should have had over 1,000, and when in a national popular vote, I think they would.
Okay. The honorable gentleman from Colorado can respond if he wants to.
I'm in agreement with all of that. You know, again, it's about, you know, you're in the business and you're in the driver's seat and you got to manage what you're doing and you got to do it as well as you can within the rules as they exist. You know, I think it was a travesty, you know, the way a candidate was set up. I think their total neglect and misunderstanding. Well, I admire the Republicans about how they figured out what was going on and what's happening in a disaffected America and how do we go about appealing with that. And the Democrats had 43 words.
I think it was.
Well, I mean, you know, that's not a good commentary on managing our own business. Let's get serious about that.
I'm going to combine two questions because they're very similar. Given that most changes to the Electoral College system will create more candidates and more parties and currently will favor Republicans, will favor Democrats, what are the chances that Congress will cast a two-thirds vote to amend the Constitution?
Well, maybe this is where I do like John, and I use the question to talk about what I want to talk about anyway. And not answer the question in the process. But I think it's kind of in that question, which is, well, what would happen if we went to a national plebiscitary vote on the president? I think it would hurt the two-party system. So, as that great liberal American historian Clinton Rossiter wrote, no America without democracy, no democracy without politics, no politics without the two-party system. And here's what he meant. His good friend Arthur Schlesinger wrote an op-ed after the 2000 election about this, about going to a national plebiscite. If you don't like candidates like Donald Trump, and I don't, you don't want a national plebiscite. Here's what Arthur Schlesinger wrote. I'm not going to bore you with all of it, but some of it is very pertinent. The direct election of the president in a national plebiscite would provide a potent incentive to single-issue zealots, freelance media adventurers, and eccentric billionaires to jump into presidential contests, accumulating votes from state to state where his friends and zealot co-adherents may live, splintering parties along the way. Now the fringe candidates have a real shot at taking the White House on a regular basis. And I think that's true. It would diminish the two-party system and encourage billionaire zealots, media stars, rock stars, people with money who have fans all over but could never carry a state and get all of the electors, but aggregate enough. And you have enough of those fringe candidates. Now you have very small plurality victors potentially going into the White House. And I think these great liberal historians are correct in that estimate.
I think that Arthur Schlesinger was a longtime contributing editor to The Nation magazine.
I'm sorry. But getting back to the question. I mean, is this all just pie in the sky? Can we actually change it? And realistically, if a change will always gore the ox of one party or the other?
Yeah, I mean, look, then I guess what is the Constitution still operative, right? Because we have the ability to amend it. That's one of our greatest protections, right? That the ability to amend the Constitution is the protection against the future, right? Against a future in which we are locked into a straitjacket from the past. And so I know it's impossible to amend the Constitution. It's never, ever happened, except for 27 times. And the fact of the matter is, one of my great efforts of the last 20 years has been to preach to people that we do need to go back to founding premises, to founding principles. And the basic and core founding principle was that if we don't like how it's operating, we should do everything we can to change it. And we should not accept the absurdity of, this party won't do that, or that party won't do that, or this may harm the parties which are not mentioned in the Constitution. And look, the bottom line is this, and I say this really passionately. If we decide, we talk ourselves out of trying to amend the Constitution, to get rid of the Electoral College, to address gerrymandering, to address money in politics, to guarantee a right to vote and a right to have that vote counted, if we talk ourselves out of that, right, then we will live our future in a zone narrowly defined that will produce, amazingly enough, the result that Arthur Schlesinger predicted. So we actually have the billionaire and the zealots. We have the worst of all worlds. We have a horrible premise playing out in our times, and we talk ourselves out of trying to fix it. That is antithetical to everything that is American. And we ought to not accept that. We ought to believe and fight and make that change.
Notice you got the billionaire zealot this time. And what did he not have the support of? Either major party. You don't have two major parties, you're going to get a lot more billionaire zealots cobbling votes together and getting into the plurality.
Not after we get start taxing the rich.
That's down the hall.
What color is the sky on your planet?
All right, here's an interesting one. I'm going to try this. This questioner says, I just came from a session where an Indonesian panelist said, in her country, if you win by 3 million votes, you win. How do you explain our system to the world?
We have the guy from the UN.
No one else has it. I'm fairly confident of that.
You ever tried to explain filibuster to anybody around the world? there are a lot of quirks in our political system to try to explain to people. It's very, very hard. There are in every one. I go back to when I was trying to do this to people, say that, what this country is an extremely interesting balance between, we started out saying, between those who wanted a strong central government and those who did not. And the country has played out that pressure and that tension, for 230 years or whatever. And we're still playing it out. The Electoral College is part of that. The way in which we're going to be thinking about tax reform is part of that. The way in which we're thinking about this health care, what kind of health care activity we're going to have, and can we get to a single-payer program? That's being played out. These issues are being played out over and over and over again. So I've had a lot of occasions to do this with lots of people trying to explain what happens in the United States. If I can figure it out myself, then explain to them and say, this is it's this basic tension. And I think, again, as I said, I think this issue, is fantastically interesting. The Electoral College issue is extraordinarily interesting because it pries open the can and gets you to look at a whole lot of the things that are there. I'm not sure that I agree with the solution, but I think that what it does is gets us to think about, a lot of the elements that are extremely important to the making of making our democracy work and work better. I am suspicious of kind of a major populist vote, in the way that this might occur and what the ramifications of that may be, and are we going to be dependent upon just a lot of big cities electing our people? I don't have any idea. We have to think about that very carefully. I don't think we've done so yet, anyway, it's a fascinating discussion.
Jim Worth is only 77 years old, and the one thing I like about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders is that they have absolutely confirmed there's no age limit on the presidency. And every time I hear this guy, I'm thinking more and more.
You're really making it up for a lot of past sins in the last hour, aren't you?
I want my president to be someone I can pressure from the left. So I was in Africa during the 2000 fight over Florida.
So was I, actually.
Were you? Were you?
Morocco.
How's that going?
They were interested, actually.
They were very interested. I was in Zimbabwe. and South Africa, and some Zimbabwean guy said, well, tell me about how this thing is going. We keep reading about this Bush v. Gore thing. And I said, well, you know, it's how our system works. And he goes, so let me get this straight. Like, the whole country votes for one guy, they count all the votes, and they say, but there's a little province down in the corner, and what they do is kind of flip it one way or the other, right? And even if they can't produce enough votes, they're like, oh, yeah. I said, yeah, well, that's how it works. He said, and the brother of one of the candidates is in charge of that province. And his campaign manager, one of his campaign coordinators, is counting the votes. And I said, well, yeah, that's how our system works. And then it goes to a Supreme Court where the dad of one of the candidates appointed several of the people on the court. And I said, yeah, that's how it works. And the guy said, boy, yeah, if we tried that, your State Department would tell us we're in trouble and we might get our foreign aid cut.
Okay.
But you know, if you think back to Florida, again, let's go back to the basic issue of competence. You know, there were three different period times during that recount that the Democrats should have won, and they blew it. They made the wrong decision three times in a row, and Bush ended up winning. They were so much better at that than we were, and I'll just tell you what it all looked like. I was very involved, and Albert Gore and I have been very close friends for a long period of time. The day after the election, this is a great story, by the way. It doesn't have anything to do with the nation. This was, there was a very large auditorium with press from all over the world wanting to know what was going to happen and how we were going to do it and what the process was going to be. The candidates flipped a coin as to who was going to go and make the case or explain to people from around the world what was happening. And the first candidate, and the Bush people won, so Gore's people went first. Warren Christopher was the chairman of the campaign. He came out from the side, you know, the stage, and there was a big lectern there. Warren Christopher was not a tall man. He came out and stood behind the lectern, shades of Michael Dukakis in The Tank. Do you remember that? But anyway, there was this head behind the podium explaining in legal monotones what the Democratic strategy was. He then went off the stage, and it was the Republicans' turn, and Jim Baker was chairman of the Republican of the effort for W. W had called him two nights before and said, or the night before, and said, would you take this on? And he said, only if I have absolute control over every decision and everything that happens in this. There were three people on the Democratic side, Boyce, Warren Christopher, and the mayor of Chicago's brother. There were three heads of the Democratic campaign. Baker was the one guy in the Republican campaign. When it came his turn to talk, he started not up on the stage, but he started back at the top of the center aisle, and he walked down the middle of the aisle like a Roman Praetorian. I mean, he was standing tall, saying hello to people, smiling at people, got up on the stage, didn't get behind the podium, had a lavalier, moved around the stage, and you thought, oh my God, you know, what is this all about? And you know what the people in that audience thought? There's no contest here. You know, it was just such a dramatic contrast. Again, I have spent a long time being an operative. I really appreciate people who do it really well and understand what the rules are and play by those rules really well and use those rules and possibly as well as you can. And we don't do, again, saying we, you know, in this blue area, this blue paradise of Boulder, you know, we don't do it very well.
It was so awful every day.
What's your opinion on holding a new constitutional convention? Perhaps not just for this issue, but on a variety of issues. It's come up in the conversation, but let's ask it directly. We've been around for 200 and I don't know how many years, do the math, and we've never had one, and it's in the Constitution for a reason. Should we have one?
Let's go to the scholar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but I believe in incrementalism. By the way, all of the great, great reforms, whether civil rights for minorities or voting rights for women, they all bubbled up from the states. They all bubbled up from the states. So I'm a big believer in incrementalism. So anything that you think would be good for the nation, have some states try it in their constitution first. Just try first. Because remember, our constitution had new stuff in it, but they were all imitating the French Montesquieuan constitution and the British constitution and tinkering with it. It's hard to build from scratch. Even the crazy old Confederate constitution was just a copy of the U.S. constitution, except for the anti-slavery clauses in the United States constitution. So let it bubble up. And then think this way about it. So if the Republicans get their balanced budget amendment that they've been wanting for a long time, and if the Democrats get their overturned Citizens United amendment, and then give them each one more, is that going to really change the tenor of national politics? One of the things Madison and the Anti-Federalists, both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, said was, look, it doesn't matter if you build a new republic unless you build new Republican citizens, which is why they wanted a national university, sort of like the French have for training judges and politicians. Unless you get a new Republican citizen devoted to deliberate, reasonable deliberation. And that's really what we've lost, the Republican citizen, lowercase r, the Roman senator, the reasonable, prudent, slow-moving, deliberative sort of legislation. And I think the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists were right about that. George Washington said it in both his inaugural addresses and in his farewell address. We need a citizenry based on civic virtue. They didn't mean religious virtue. They meant the political Republican virtues because, ladies and gentlemen, at the end of the day, be nice, like Sister Mary Gertrude told you in first grade. Be nice to your neighbors because you got to live with them the rest of your life. So don't badmouth Ames, Iowa, and I won't badmouth this pot-polluted city of yours.
There we go. It's required at one pot joke per session. It's part of the rules.
Quickly, how many people think the system's just working great right now?
Nobody else.
There you go. You got a guy. I love you, brother. And
it's not supposed to work.
No, but that's not what I'm going someplace that actually ends up about where you are. So stop with the silly talk. All right.
I'm scared. You're agreeing with me.
Not much. Anyways, if you think the thing is just great right now, then yeah, maybe we've got, you know, maybe we can, you know, come together and do a constitutional convention. That's great. But you understand that to get to a constitutional convention, new constitutional convention, right? We can call it that if you like. And but to get there, we have to figure out how we're going to pick the people that are going to be there. How they're going to be instructed? Are they going to be elected? Are they going to be chosen by the legislatures? Right now, the model is that they're talking about having legislatures, transitory legislatures,
choose the delegates.
Choose the delegates. That, you know. So my caution on it: I have immense faith in the American people. I think if the American people are going to the old theory of if you pulled the first two pages out of the Dubuque phone book, you could probably get a better Congress. But I've been to Dubuque, and I'm, you know, now if it was Boulder, I'm sure. The bottom line is this. We have to be systemic about this stuff. We have to understand, you know, if the system works, right, and we have money out of politics and really great small-d democracy, I think we can really explore a lot of constitutional reform, and I think it's super exciting. Up to that point, I like the way that we have done it for over 200 years. We've amended the Constitution 27 times. It's doable. And the fact is, the crisis of our moment is that our political and our media elites tell us it isn't doable. They tell us America doesn't work, that it doesn't function. I come to tell you that it must work. It must function. Just as it needed to function so that women could get the vote, so that we could have an elected Senate, so we could get rid of the poll tax. It's time for us to work on constitutional amendments, But it's not time for us, in my view, to look for the easy out of a constitutional convention, which I think will be gamed by the same people that are gaming our process right now.
We do agree.
All right, I'm going to ask a question on behalf of a student here, but several asked this question. Is there a organized effort nationally to get rid of the Electoral College? If so, who's leading it? And how do people in this room, particularly in this case college students, young people, get involved?
Yeah, there you go. Useful, very useful question. Yeah. There are a lot of things going on. The National Popular Vote was mentioned. I'm not going to go into all the details of that. But that's a real movement, and it's got, you know, some energy behind it. I actually have some questions about it, but that you can Google National Popular Vote Initiative and look at efforts to do it on a state-by-state basis. Senator Nelson from Florida has had an amendment for some time on eliminating the Electoral College. And we have a great new congressman from Maryland. Jamie Raskin, R-A-S-K-I-N.
Oh, I know Jamie.
Jamie's a constitutional scholar. Jamie is like, I think of him as a young Tim Wood. And, but the thing about Jamie that's really cool, I'm not kidding, he is a young reformer who's come up, he's gotten himself elected to Congress. This guy actually helped to write the amendment to overturn Citizens United. He's been very involved in the right to vote movements. He is super involved in this Electoral College stuff. And so rather than listen to me, I invite you to Google his website and take a look. And I think you'll find a lot of interesting ideas there. And I think he's brand new to Congress, but often the brand new to Congress people are the best leaders.
You know what? That's an interesting question. Like, is there an organized group? And I find myself having the following reaction. There may be an organized group and people sign up. But what we're doing is asking people to sign up for something that actually nothing's going to happen. Chances are nothing's going to happen. And you get a lot of people who use up a lot of energy, run right into a brick wall and say, see, the system doesn't work. You know, I would, you know, if I were talking to a group of students saying, where do you put your time? I wouldn't say putting it into Electoral College reform. I'd say, look at the state legislature in the state of Colorado. You know, I think there were down one vote in the state Senate, you know, to getting a reasonable majority in that is, you know, if a lot of student power went into that particular election, it would make a huge difference. You know, what's going to happen in terms of the governor's race? You know, getting involved in this governor's race is going to be really interesting. You know, who are there some good Democrats running, and it's going to come down to a head-to-head. And I say to kids, I say the most important thing you can do is to get into a campaign and just immerse yourself in it. You'll learn more in that than you ever will imagine. But finally, make sure that it's something where there's some possibilities. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, some people like to work on dead-end things. I don't. I want to make sure to go to that student. It's a really good question from that young person about what to do. And the question is, how do people spend their time?
So it's been a wonderful panel.